American Democracy in Question, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Last night, Donald Trump refused to say if he'd respect the outcome of the election. Today, he said this.
I will totally accept the results of this great and historic presidential election if I win.
We ask a Trump supporter what she makes of that.
The idea that this was, you know, a statement of revolution or he's going to overthrow the system, I think is, you know, way beyond what his intention was.
Plus, we call up Mexican-American cartoonist Lalo Alcaraz for his reaction to Trump's bad hombres line at the debate.
You reach 1-800-BAD-HOMBRE. How may I help you or hurt you?
That's all ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us today. We start with an extraordinary moment from last night's presidential debate. It came when moderator Chris Wallace asked Donald Trump if he would accept the outcome of the election.
I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense. Okay?
Well, Chris, let me respond to that because that's horrifying.
Questioning one of the foundations of American democracy will certainly keep Trump in the headlines. In a few minutes, we'll hear a Trump supporter's reaction to that wait-and-see attitude. For his part, Trump took it a step further today during a campaign stop.
I would like to promise and pledge to all of my voters and supporters and to all of the people of the United States that I will totally accept the results of this great an historic presidential election if I win.
Here at The World, we've covered a lot of elections across the globe, and we've come across places where even the mere allegation of vote rigging had a huge impact. Let's go first to Mexico. That's where The World's Monica Campbell is based.
It was extremely tight. There were two main candidates. One was Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And then he was running against Felipe Calderon. So these two, they're running neck and neck. And along comes July 2nd, 2006, Election Day. And Calderon won by a few 100,000 votes among more than 40 million votes that were cast. López Obrador said that there was fraud, that the ballot boxes had been tampered with, and he called for a recount. He also launched a legal battle that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he lost. And what we saw in 2006 were huge street protests, and they lasted for months and right up until Felipe Calderon was inaugurated.
Why did it turn into such a big deal?
What happened was that a lot of Mexicans already didn't have much trust in the electoral system. You didn't have to go back too far. You had an extremely memorable case in 1988. There was another tight race. And the day of the election, the computerized vote tabulation system crashed right on Election Day. The government said it broke down. When the computers were restored, the candidate from the party that had held power here in Mexico for decades and decades, he came out ahead. After 1988, you had other instances where there was electoral fraud or at least very strong allegations of fraud. So a lot of Mexicans, you know, this isn't new. There's been a lot of allegations of voter fraud. And so 2006, when we saw this really thinly won election by Felipe Calderon, a lot of Mexicans were just up in arms. And they just said, you know, here we go again. We thought we were turning a page, entering a new chapter of democracy here in Mexico. And 2006 was just a slap in the face for a lot of people.
So I guess the lesson is, in a developing democracy where there actually has been voter fraud, charges of voter fraud immediately are taken seriously.
Absolutely. And I think that that will continue. I think what we're seeing, López Obrador, who lost in 2006, he's still in politics in Mexico, very much so. And what we're seeing today is with the lack of popularity of the current president, he's got every chance to be a strong contender again in the 2018 presidential election here. So the hangover of electoral fraud here and the allegations of it and the mistrust in the system, it's not going away. And the idea that a system can be rigged here in Mexico is still very strong.
Monica, based on your observations of Mexican elections, do you think that Trump's comments could hurt the way people view American democracy?
Well, I'm speaking from Mexico. So when it comes to Trump, there is nobody who's less popular than Trump right now in Mexico. So people have been watching this election extremely closely, this campaign extremely closely, and they have seen how divisive Trump is and how polarizing this campaign has become. There's not a lot of doubt here that Trump has been losing ground to Clinton, and that what it looks like now is that he's, you know, pulling Hail Marys and trying to say that it's going to be rigged election and that we can't have faith in the outcome. My strong feeling, and having talked to Mexicans about this, is that Trump is flailing, and Mexicans see that. And they see the U.S. election system as one that's considered a model in the world. I don't think Trump is going to hurt that perception.
The World's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Mexico is not the only country where allegations of vote rigging have led to protests and instability. In Iran, there were charges of electoral fraud in 2009. Some Iranians dismissed those charges. Others felt they were justified. Barbara Slavin remembers that election well. She's a longtime Iran watcher and a friend of the show.
Well, there were very credible allegations of fraud. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was then the president, was running for re-election, and they announced that he had won in an obscenely short amount of time, something like a couple of hours. And of course, Iran at the time had paper ballots. It was no one believed that he had actually won. The margin of victory was also very high, even though the opposing candidates had a great deal of popularity. It led to the biggest political crisis in Iran since the 1979 revolution. Massive demonstrations that were put down with force and with multiple arrests. It was a huge crisis.
And in that instance, how did the opposition, what did they say about the election? How did they respond?
They believed that the election had been stolen from them. As I said, there were massive public protests. They went on for months and really did not die down for a couple of years. And there is still a belief among many that the true winner was a man named Mir Hossein Mousavi. Instead, he was put under house arrest along with another candidate, Mehdi Karoubi, and they're still under house arrest in Iran all these years later. So it was very dramatic. It was very traumatic. I certainly hope and do not assume that the United States will go through anything like that.
How are people in Iran following the campaign?
Very closely. They love our elections. I mean, I was there in 2008 when people were riveted by Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton. And so now, I mean, this is an incredible drama, obviously. They're following it very closely. They're watching the debates, which apparently are being shown live with Farsi translation. Of course, the outcome could affect Iran. It could affect whether the nuclear deal survives. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump is not beloved in Iran, although some hardline elements probably would prefer him to win because he would be an easier foil for the Iranian government. Clinton is not entirely trusted either. She has been much more hawkish, at least in her rhetoric on Iran, even though she was in the Obama administration during a time of outreach to Iran and negotiations.
Barbara, I'm curious, you've observed a lot of Iranian elections, and, you know, it's a very different process, but there's also been a lot of reaction and ups and downs after them. And so in our own American election, when you hear talk about kind of not respecting the results, how does it make you feel?
The Iranians have something called a guardian council, which vets all their candidates for office. It eliminates, frankly, many people we would like to see run, but it also eliminates frivolous candidates who have no qualifications for the job of president or the job of member of parliament. And there have been a lot of jokes, you know, that the United States could use a guardian council to prevent someone as unqualified as Donald Trump from running for such a high office. Obviously, we don't need a guardian council here, but it is an interesting point of view. So all I can say is this very sad and dispiriting campaign that we've had in the U.S., all the vulgarity has really, I think, diminished our image in the world. People, you know, can say now that our democracy is not exactly a model. And if, God forbid, anyone was to challenge the results of our election or allege massive fraud, I think that would be even more damaging to our image in the world.
Barbara Slavin is acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. She's also the author of a book on Iran-U.S. relations. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to get a Trump supporter's take on all of this, so we called up Kate Long from New York's Hudson Valley. She says Trump raises a valid point.
He's referring to instances where the Democratic Party has, you know, done things which many people feel either is close to fraud or wouldn't really represent the intention of the people. I think he'll walk it back. I think Pence already, his vice president already has said that generally they'll accept the results if they're fair and if there is no widespread instance of fraud or collusion in the election.
When Chris Wallace pressed him, he said, well, I'm going to keep you in suspense and I'll just wait and see on the day. So it's hard to really interpret what he means.
Yeah, I think overall, Trump not being a politician probably makes statements that a more polished person that has been in office for a long time wouldn't make. And I think probably over the next couple of weeks, he'll soften that. The idea that this was, you know, a statement of revolution or he's going to overthrow the system, I think is, you know, way beyond what his intention was.
I don't think it's been interpreted that way, but I think it has been interpreted as something that challenges a very foundation of American democracy. One of the things that makes American democracy work is a peaceful transition of power. Some people are concerned that his stance is undermining that.
Well, it is definitely disruptive to say that, you know, on election night, without reviewing any results in any places, that he will just, you know, 100% concede. But, you know, I think it is fair also to allow him to say, you know, I would like to see what the results are. I would like to see, you know, what happens in various places and, you know, make a decision on that basis. I mean, I can understand both sides of the discussion, but I do think that there was a lot more that happened in the debate last night than his statement at the end.
But are you concerned about any of the things he said, whether about immigration or his anti-Muslim rhetoric, about women? Does any of that give you pause?
Definitely. I mean, he's a very imperfect candidate. There's no question that his back and forth statements on women and objectifying women is not great. Does it disqualify him to be commander in chief? No, I don't think so. His comments on Muslims, you know, I think that there's been some misunderstanding about his statements. He specifically has said he wants to do what he calls extreme vetting on refugees or people coming from Syria, where there is very little evidence of, you know, somebody's background. I think that's legitimate.
Actually, there's been enhanced screening for refugees from Syria and not a huge number of Syrian refugees, given the number that are in need of a home.
Right. But, you know, there is no established government. I mean, there's the Assad government in Syria, but there's no way to verify people's background coming from Syria. So, you know, I think he raises legitimate concerns. They're portrayed as extreme, but I think in many cases they're really not that extreme.
There's rigorous vetting of Syrian refugees. What more can be done?
I don't know, but if you look at Europe, you look at France, you look at the Netherlands, you look at the UK, you look at Germany, they obviously have open borders and have been accepting a lot more refugees. But as part of that, you know, the German police have said that terrorists have come in. And there's no reason not to put more effort into screening people coming out of the Middle East or actually anywhere if we're going to keep the country safe.
Kate, going back to what Donald Trump said, his wait-and-see attitude about the outcome, will you accept the outcome of this election?
Well, yes, of course. Yeah, I'll be voting on November 8th and, you know, look forward to, you know, whoever is serving as president of the country on November 9th. Absolutely.
Kate Long is a Donald Trump supporter. She's been speaking to us from the Hudson Valley in New York State. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Syrian refugees learn to call Boise, Idaho home here on The World. The war in Syria took a break today. The pause in fighting was announced by the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Of course, it's not the first time in the 5.5-year war that fighting has been put on hold, however briefly. Same with the war in Yemen. Just yesterday, warring sides there agreed to a ceasefire. Few people in either Syria or Yemen think the ceasefires will hold, but Jason Quinn says we shouldn't feel too down. He's a professor at the University of Notre Dame, and he's looked at conflicts dating back to 1975. Professor Quinn, what did the data tell you about ceasefires in the past and their actual role in ending wars?
When we started looking at what we call the chains of ceasefire agreements, so when one follows another, our thoughts were that a series of failures might create some kind of a negative cascade effect where the parties kind of get down and say, well, this didn't work in the past. It probably won't work this time. But what we found was really the opposite. Ceasefire agreements, and there's been hundreds of them, they failed at a rate of about 80%. But what we found was that the best predictor that any one ceasefire agreement will be successful, and by successful, I mean not followed by renewed conflict or violence. The best predictor that any one ceasefire agreement will be successful is how many failed peace agreements came before it.
So failed ceasefires?
Yes.
Let's look at a ceasefire in place today in Syria. Should we look at this as an incremental step in settling this war, or is it a break to allow humanitarian aid in, to allow, you know, some movement, but this isn't really a step toward a peace agreement?
Oh, I see it as a step toward a peace agreement, even if it fails. Like I said, I think ceasefires only really have a purpose, logic, in a larger peace process. You know, the way that the policy debates typically unfold on radio shows and in magazines is they tend to be portrayed as a debate, which outcome is better, military solution or a peace agreement, that one outcome is better than the other. When in fact, most large civil wars end in a particular sequence of outcomes. Usually the moderates come together, spend several years in negotiations towards a comprehensive agreement, and then after that is reached, other groups that remain on the periphery join the process. There's always going to be a few hardliner groups that won't join regardless because they want to have unilateral control over the state. That's always going to happen. That's going to be the case in Syria for sure. But what happens is as moderates see that the peace process is viable, they'll join in. They don't want to miss out. Fear of missing out is a strong motivation. There's always going to be a few hardliner groups that hold out, but those can be militarily defeated. This is a proven sequence that have ended many large, deadly, complex civil wars in the past. And even if the first agreement fails, I mean, the research shows that the second or third agreement will tend to hold.
Professor Jason Quinn, along with his colleague at Notre Dame, Madhav Joshi, published a study of 196 ceasefires from 1975 to 2011. Professor Quinn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
While Syria struggles to maintain a ceasefire, people continue to flee the country. The United States takes in some of these refugees. 122 of them have ended up in Boise, Idaho this year. That's more than twice the number of Syrian refugees taken in by Los Angeles, Boston, and New York combined. We sent the world's Jason Margolis to Boise. He met the first Syrian refugee to be placed there. That was in 2014.
Asma Albukayi was married at age 14. She had two children by the time she was 15. Then she took an unusual step for a stay-at-home Syrian mom. She signed up for a university degree in library science in Damascus.
I noticed that people, you know, women in a movie, American women, decide whatever they want to decide. And this is not acceptable in Syria, so I make my own decision to learn and study, but I hide in a bathroom because my husband didn't allow me to study.
Asma told me her story in a coffee shop in downtown Boise. We spoke for about 90 minutes. She told me a lot of details about her life in Syria, then say, please don't share that part. She wants to protect her family still in Syria. It's a learned defense not to criticize anybody.
If I spoke in a bad way, you will not see me alive here.
Here's what she says I can share. Asma's husband and her two young boys were kidnapped. She never saw her husband again, but she got her two boys back, then immediately left for Jordan, then Egypt. She applied for refugee status through the United Nations. After 2 years of interviews and background checks, she got a ticket for the United States.
And then on my flight, it's written Boise, ID, which is Idaho. Now I know, but before I didn't know. And I started Google that.
Naturally, it was a difficult transition, being the very first Syrian refugee in the entire state of Idaho.
The hardest part, like everything, learning how to pay the bill, learning how to drive, because I got a stick shift car. People was yelling at me in the middle of the street because my car died. And they, you know, call me names and crazy and F-word.
Angry drivers aside, Asma says Boise has been a very welcoming community.
I have a lot of nice friend here, and I'm working, and I'm safe.
But that's changing. Asma wears a hijab, and she says people have screamed at her and called her a terrorist. A man recently assaulted her 16-year-old son.
He was with his friend, and there's an American guy asked him, are you Muslim? And my son said, yes, I am Muslim. And he punished him in his face.
The assailant was arrested and charged under Idaho's hate crime law. Asma wouldn't criticize any American politicians for the heightened animosity toward Muslims. She's afraid if she says the wrong thing, she might get deported. Legally, that can't happen. Asma spoke to me because she wants Americans to understand the refugee vetting process to get here. All applicants are first screened by the UN, then three U.S. government agencies, the State Department, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services. The process to admit Syrian refugees takes 18 to 24 months, if they pass all the hurdles. Around 10,000 Syrian refugees have been accepted to the U.S. over the past 12 months. Hillary Clinton has said she'd like to increase the annual intake to 65,000. Donald Trump has repeatedly said, we know nothing about the background of Syrian refugees. Here he is speaking to Clinton at last night's debate.
She's taken in tens of thousands of Syrian refugees who probably, in many cases, not probably, who are definitely, in many cases, ISIS-aligned. And we now have them in our country. And wait till you see, this is going to be the great Trojan horse. And wait.
This is what upsets me, because I love the country. I love America. America is a... this country is my mother. When he said Syrian coming without any paperwork, he should see my paperwork and other people, you know, paperwork. It's huge. We went through a lot of interviews, a lot of background check.
How many interviews did you have?
More than 10 interviews, and a lot of them were scary and not comfortable. In small rooms, no windows, like investigation.
You said they were scary.
Scary, yeah, because they ask a lot of questions and a lot of embarrassing questions too. Like, answer yes or no. Do you want to bomb an airplane?
What about the people who are scared of Muslims? How do you assure them that you're not a terrorist?
Well, sometimes, when people saying terrorist to me, when I smile and wave and say hello, their face change from somebody mad to somebody, you know, more calm. So I believe Muslim attitude can change what American people think about Muslim.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Boise, Idaho.
You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. This election is causing a rift within Miami's Haitian community. It's even put this father and daughter at odds with each other.
I don't agree with his decision to vote for Trump.
I don't care. I don't care. You don't like it? Okay.
How Trump versus Clinton plays out in Little Haiti. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Well, the debates are over, and now Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are going to hit the road in earnest for the final two-plus weeks of campaigning. They both have a lot of work to do, no matter what the polls say, and there are countless constituencies that can't be taken for granted by either side. Take Florida's Haitian community. In the past, it's been a solid voting bloc for Democrats. But listen to what Trump said last night at the debate in Las Vegas.
You take a look at the people of Haiti. I was at Little Haiti the other day in Florida. And I want to tell you, they hate the Clintons, because what's happened in Haiti with the Clinton Foundation is a disgrace.
We'll hear more about how people in Haiti feel about Bill and Hillary Clinton in just a few minutes. First, we head to Miami's Little Haiti section. WLRN reporter Nadej Green talked to some voters there.
Mapalo, Trump. Okay, Trump mapalo. Salve pour Haiti.
I'm at a restaurant in Little Haiti with Edouard Salnav. He supports Donald Trump. His daughter, Rachel Salnav.
I don't agree with his decision to vote for Trump.
I don't care. I don't care. You don't like it? Okay. If you don't want me to be your father anymore, change who you're going to vote and vote for Trump.
Dad, Edouard has been a U.S. citizen for 50 years. He was a Democrat until this year, when he switched his party affiliation to Republican.
I believe in Mr. Trump. He's believe in America.
We met before the tapes came out, where Trump boasted about groping women without their consent. Edouard says he still stands by Trump. Rachel was a Bernie Sanders supporter, but back at the restaurant, she said she's not with her, Hillary Clinton. Rachel does know who she's not voting for, Donald Trump.
See, the thing is, this is like a political chess move. So if I go ahead, and many of the Haitians here go ahead and say, we're definitely not voting for Trump, so our only answer is Clinton, then does she have accountability? Because she knows we'll vote for her.
Clinton's problem among Haitian Americans, who mostly lean Democratic, is similar to what she faces in other Black communities. People are not excited about her candidacy. When Obama ran for office, songs about him in French and Creole blasted in Creole language radio programs. Obama, Obama, Obama. For Hillary Clinton, there are no songs. Clinton has a complicated history in Haiti. As Secretary of State, she was sharply criticized for helping to get former Haiti President Michel Martelly elected. And the Clinton Foundation continues to face backlash over its role in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. Critics say there's a lack of transparency about what the foundation has done there. When Donald Trump spoke in Little Haiti, Gelson Loresan came to hear him.
The Clintons had been running the country for so long, and they have not done anything for the Haitian community. Now I think it's time to give the baton to Mr. Trump.
Just a few doors down from where Trump visited, there's a Clinton campaign office. The campaign ran a radio ad in Creole called La Kainu, Our Home.
Puis groupe pas nous en puis souffrir pas sans pilote. Hillary Clinton comprend tribulation a passé.
The narrator says Hillary Clinton has a plan to build a stronger economy and better paying jobs. But getting out the vote for Clinton is still a challenge. Francesca Menez is working on Black immigrant outreach in Florida. She understands the reluctance some Haitian Americans have towards Clinton.
So it's like, how do we get our people to actually mobilize for her?
Back at the restaurant in Little Haiti, Edouard Salnave and his daughter, Rachel, are finishing lunch. Edouard says ever since he became a Trump supporter, he doesn't have many fans.
Everybody disappointed for me because I do that. I don't care.
He points to his daughter, Rachel.
She don't like me.
Of course I don't hate him. Of course I don't hate my father.
Rachel disagrees with her dad's choice, but she says she's still a fan of his. For the World, Nadege Green, Miami.
We wanted to fact check some of the criticisms mentioned there, especially after Donald Trump's comment last night that Haitians hate Hillary Clinton. The World's Amy Bracken is just back from Haiti. And Amy, is it true? Do Haitians hate the Clintons?
Yeah, I would say that many do. I think what's really remarkable, though, is how much public sentiment has changed over the years. I mean, the Clintons as a couple, as newlyweds, visited Haiti back in the 70s. And for a long time, they were seen as friends and allies of the country. A lot has happened. A lot has changed over the last decades. And today, yeah, there are some people who really have a lot of hatred for the Clintons.
One of the things we just heard in that piece was how Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, traveled to Haiti in 2011, and she's criticized for meddling with the electoral process. What's that about?
Well, yeah, I think you could say that she did. In those elections, they were disputed. There was a first round that happened in 2010, and Michel Martelly, one of the candidates, came in third place. You need to be in second place in order to go to the second round. Martelly supporters were furious. They claimed that there had been fraud. And there were threats of violence. There were a lot of protests. And Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, flew to Haiti and met with the president at the time, René Préval, to discuss how to deal with this. The result was that the first place candidate, whose victory was seen as fraudulent by some, was eliminated from the running. And Martelly came in second in the first round and eventually won in the second round.
But he eventually became really unpopular before he stepped down earlier this year. How come?
He was seen as corrupt, as nepotistic. He had a little bit of the brash personality style of Donald Trump that really started to grate on people more and more. He said very offensive things about women, for example. There were elections that he was supposed to organize that he did not organize, and they were massively delayed. So he really lost trust. And when he lost trust, people also became very angry with Hillary Clinton.
We also heard about the Clinton Foundation facing a backlash. But to date, is there any actual evidence that the Clinton Foundation did anything wrong or anything illegal?
there is not evidence that they did anything illegal that we know of. There have been some claims, particularly by the Trump camp, that contracts were going to supporters of the foundation. That does not seem to be the case. People complain about a lack of transparency, and there are a lot of suspicions.
Then there's the whole issue of Hillary's brother, Tony Rodham, that somehow he's been involved in business ventures in Haiti after the earthquake. Any evidence of conflict of interest or insider dealings there?
No, there aren't. He said that he met one of his business partners at a Clinton Foundation party. He seems to have asked the Clintons for help. It's not clear whether he actually did. He was involved in advising a board on gold mining in Haiti. It's not clear. Many, many people will tell you that they're convinced that that has something to do with the Clintons and maybe the Clinton Foundation, but it's not. There isn't evidence for that that we know of.
Now, you talked to Haitians during your last trip, and I assume you asked them about Donald Trump. What do they think of him?
Well, it's funny. I have one friend who likes to joke with me that that we deserve Donald Trump because we gave them Michel Martelly, that we've meddled in so many elections to the detriment of their country that he wants to sit back and laugh at what's happening here. I think that there's a strong dislike for Donald Trump in Haiti, a country that's generally supported Democrats or lean Democrats as far as the U.S. elections are concerned. But, yeah, I mean, there are occasional snide remarks about the Clintons as well.
So overall, do you think Haiti is looking on at this presidential election and thinking Clinton or Trump?
Well, since the hurricane, I think that people are really focused elsewhere. I think especially after the reconstruction and the recovery from the earthquake, there aren't very high hopes that the U.S. is really going to come to the rescue in a way that people might have hoped after the earthquake.
The World's Amy Bracken, just back from Haiti. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Carol.
Endless challenges have sent a regular stream of immigrants from that country to the U.S. Most of them come here directly. But there's another route these days via Brazil and Mexico. A lot of Haitians have found work in Brazil in recent years, but with that country's economy now sinking, many of them there are now trying to get here. Of course, they're not guaranteed entry, so a lot of these Haitians are now stuck in Tijuana. Reporter Alexandra Hall went to the border city to find out more.
In a quiet Tijuana neighborhood, Haitian migrants mill about in the morning light. Some rest on blankets under trees, others play dominoes. There's Babo Piejo, who's 44. He's wearing a backpack, a sweatshirt ripped at the neck, and talks to his wife in Creole. The couple and their baby boy got here about 2 weeks ago, migrating from Brazil. They'd lived there ever since the massive 2010 earthquake in Haiti forced them to leave.
Yo estaba en Brasil, entonces la cosa no está muy bueno.
But Babo says things are bad now in Brazil. He worked in construction there, but since the economy tanked, he couldn't make enough to support his family. He hopes for something better in the U.S. Babo shows me a document that Mexican officials gave him at the Guatemala border. The document says Babo and his family have an appointment with U.S. immigration officials on October 26th. What happens after that, whether they'll be allowed into the U.S., is unknown. Father Pat Murphy is seeing a lot of people like Babo. He runs Casa del Migrante, a shelter in Tijuana. He says thousands of migrants from many countries, including African nations, have shown up here this year. But recently, it's been Haitians coming from Brazil.
Some of them went there as long as 4 years ago, 6 years ago, with visas to work. The work stopped and the economy went south, and so they're all coming this way. And they come by plane, boat, walking, horse, buses.
Until recently, many Haitians thought they'd just need to show up at the border, ask for asylum, and get in. Haitians were generally protected from deportation after the 2010 quake. But this September, as the number of Haitians heading to the border increased, the Obama administration said it would step up deportations. Officials said conditions in Haiti had improved. Then, just a few days ago, officials switched gears again, delaying the new policy because of Hurricane Matthew's destruction. That back and forth has created delays. Haitian women cook in a kitchen lent to them by a Mexican woman here. They serve fried chicken and spaghetti onto styrofoam plates. Roselda Faton made the journey with her husband. parts of Central America, she says, were tough. Nicaragua isn't letting Haitians through, so she had to pay a smuggler thousands of dollars to cross, walking for 7 days.
For me to cross the Nicaragua border to go to Honduras, it was by boat.
She says a baby on the boat fell off and drowned.
And there was a lady who was pregnant or so. A lot of people lost their lives.
She says she saw dead bodies along the way. But she made it to Tijuana. And like so many others here, she doesn't know what will happen next. Advocates like Father Murphy think hundreds, if not thousands, of Haitian migrants are being held in U.S. detention centers right now. It's tough to confirm. But Roselda also heard that deportations have stopped, at least for now. And she wonders when they'll begin again. U.S. officials aren't saying. One thing she does know is that the number of Haitian migrants on their way here isn't slowing down.
Right now I'm talking to you, there are tons of people in Panama.
Each one, she says, paying up to $4,000, like she did, to travel those thousands of miles, through thick jungle at times, to get to the U.S.
If you stand in a place and see where the people are passing in the jungle, you will cry. Seriously. But I'm not crying because I say, this is life.
Roselda will make her case to immigration officials on October 29th. Until then, the only thing to do is wait. For The World, Alex Hall, Tijuana, Mexico.
One last note before the break. Haiti and the U.S. are about to have something in common. For the first time ever, the U.S. presidential election will be monitored by a group called the Organization of American States, or OAS. Usually the OAS monitors elections in more volatile Latin American countries like Haiti, Colombia, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic. In fact, most countries in Central and South America have had their elections monitored at some point. Now the U.S. is set to join them. OAS monitors will be present at select polling stations across the country on November 8th. Some news outlets are linking this development to Donald Trump's claims about the U.S. election being rigged. Not necessarily so, says Michael Schifter of the D.C.-based think tank Inter-American Dialogue.
I think it's easy to and tempting to interpret what's happening as because of the very unusual U.S. election and the fact that one candidate is talking about a rigged process. But I think that is not the motivation and the explanation of why this has happened at this point. I think it goes to much broader questions of the Obama administration policy.
Schifter says the U.S. has been trying to get certain countries in the region to allow monitors in for years, places like Venezuela and Nicaragua, where experts say the risk of fraudulent elections may be high. But some countries don't take kindly to the U.S.'s top-down approach.
It was always seen as somewhat hypocritical that the United States was urging other governments to accept election monitoring, but not the United States. And the fact that the United States is doing so, I think, gives the U.S. government greater legitimacy and reduces the hypocrisy, and it makes harder for other governments to respond saying, well, the United States won't accept monitors, why should we?
Schifter says U.S. voters won't be aware that the OAS monitoring is going on, just like most voters aren't aware that European monitors have been overseeing U.S. elections for a while now. Besides, the Organization of American States has pretty serious financial constraints, and so they won't be sending a huge team of observers. Just ahead, a Mexican-American cartoonist says yes, he's one bad hombre. You're with The World. Until 1967, sex between men was illegal in England. Those found guilty of doing so could be sentenced to prison or even chemical castration. But today, the British government announced it would pardon many of the men convicted under those laws. Our man in London, Leo Hornack, joins me now to talk about this. Leo, what is the new proposal?
The idea is to try and right a historical wrong, Carol. People who were convicted, and there's about 15,000 people, it's estimated, still alive who are convicted under these laws, should be now pardoned.
Why is this happening now?
Well, that's where it gets a bit more sort of showbizzy, Carol. This movement to go back and retroactively pardon people who are convicted under these laws actually stems from a movie. There was a film called The Imitation Game starring Benedict Cumberbatch, which looked at the tragic story of Alan Turing, who was one of the great code breakers, one of the great British code breakers in the Second World War. He was gay and he was actually convicted of homosexual activity and he eventually killed himself. Now, in the wake of that film, which touched a lot of people, a campaign grew up, an online campaign initially, where, with a petition where people signed it saying that it's not good enough to say that we now allow people to just follow their heart and be with whoever they want to be. We actually need to look at the fact that there's still people alive who were convicted under these laws, and really we deserve to go back and correct the historical record.
Leo, did those laws apply to women too?
No, they didn't, Carol. I mean, this is one of the many strange things, and it makes you realize just how different the morality of the 19th century when these laws were brought in is from our own now, and how drastically ideas of sexuality have changed in that time. In the laws that were brought in 1885 that made gross indecency an offense, it only applied to men. And there's a sort of popular myth that this was because Queen Victoria didn't believe that sex between women was possible. That's been pretty thoroughly debunked. And in any case, Queen Victoria didn't really have much control over legislation brought in by Parliament. But perhaps that myth does reflect a sort of underlying truth that the moral panic about gay sex was very much focused on the idea of male gay sex. And in fact, gay sex between women has actually never been illegal technically under British law.
How is this news being received in Britain?
That is also very interesting. It is, of course, been very sort of positively received by many gay rights organizations. But there are some of the older generation, men who actually lived under these laws and were forced into a kind of secret life as a result of them, who don't feel so positively. And it's all to do with the word pardon, because you might say that a pardon is something you get if you've done something wrong and been forgiven. That's very different from having the offence removed in the first place. One of those who has been complaining is a gentleman, a gay rights activist, who's actually in his 90s now. His name's George Montague, and here's what he told some of my colleagues at the BBC.
There never should have been an offence of gross indecency. It didn't apply to heterosexuals. That's not right, surely. I will not accept a pardon. To accept a pardon means you accept that you were guilty. I was not guilty of anything. I was only guilty of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Are there others who feel like George Montague?
Yes, I mean, that's been one of the sort of debates that's been going on. But you can say that in Britain, just as in America, the idea of gay rights being a perfectly mainstream and a perfectly normal part of political discourse has been pretty thoroughly accepted. You're not going to find many parts of mainstream political opinion saying that something like this is a bad plan.
The World's Leo Hornack in London. Thanks, Leo.
Thank you, Carol.
Finally today, one last item from last night's presidential debate. If you spent any time at all looking at social media today, you'll know that there was some colorful language used. One expression from Donald Trump that took off on Twitter came when he talked about immigration, about building a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico, and about dealing with millions of people here in the U.S. illegally.
One of my first acts will be to get all of the drug lords, all of the bad ones. We have some bad, bad people in this country that have to go out. We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
The expression from Trump, bad hombres, apparently brought a surge of inquiries at the Merriam-Webster website. We've got Lalo Alcaraz on the line to walk us through this. He's a Mexican-American political cartoonist from California. Lalo, what was your reaction when you first heard Trump say bad hombres?
When I first heard Trump say bad hombres, it was like the VP debate when they said, you just whipped out that Mexican thing again. I knew it was going to be the line of the night. Little did I know that it was the line of the night, but little did I know that Trump was going to announce that he was not going to accept the results of the election, which is kind of a slightly bigger deal, you know?
Now, Lalo, I followed your work for a while. You don't tend to hold back when it comes to Trump. But is there anything about Hillary Clinton that you've taken aim at with your satire?
Well, sure. I think, you know, I had this discussion at the SoulCon comic convention recently in Columbus, Ohio, and I did a panel with African-American cartoonist Keith Knight. And that question was posed to us, like, how many times have you drawn Hillary Clinton? And I raised my hand and said, you know, seriously, I'm sick of drawing Donald Trump, and I've done about 3 to 5 Hillary cartoons. Most of them are about her email, you know, the never-ending email scandal. But really, my bottom line is when somebody attacks immigrants, that's why I dedicated myself to going after Trump as much for the whole year. And Keith Knight focused on Black Lives Matter, you know, another huge pressing topic. And so it's been a really weird election year. I'm not sure that I've ever gone after one candidate so much. It's usually a little more balanced. I'm not the most balanced cartoonist out there, but seriously, this is like worrisome. This guy is one bad hombre.
Have you drawn your cartoon yet in response to bad hombres?
I just submitted the black and white version to my syndicate, and it consists of Trump on a balcony dressed as a Latin American dictator, like a generalissimo, and he's has his hand up in the air, and he says, "I will not accept the results of this election." And then he has this big ceremonial sash and just says, "Bad hombre."
Lalo, it's great talking to you. Appreciate you being with us today.
Yeah, same here.
We've been speaking to Lalo Alcaraz, a political cartoonist from California. Thanks, Lalo.
Thanks. I am also one bad hombre.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.